Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments I'll be joining Jill Bevilacqua for her weekly reflection on the Sunday Gospel. Intriguing title of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, the programme begins, as always, with Sean Patrick Lovett reading the Gospel for us.
Jesus went to his own part of the country, followed by his disciples. When the Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogue, in a way that kept his large audience amazed. They said, "Where did he get all this? What kind of wisdom is he endowed with? How is it such miraculous deeds are accomplished by his hands? Isn't this the carpenter, the son of Mary, a brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? Aren't his sisters our neighbors here?" They found him too much for them. Jesus' response to all this was, "No prophet is without honor except in his native place, among his own kindred and in his own house." He could work no miracle there, apart from curing a few who were sick by laying hands on them. So much did their lack of faith distress him. He made the rounds of the neighboring villages instead and spent his time teaching.
Without naming it, Mark tells us here of a visit to Nazareth, our Lord's hometown, or rather village as it was then. Matthew, too, avoids using the name, whereas Luke states clearly that he came to Nazareth where he had been brought up. It may be only a coincidence, but as Mark is ghostwriting for Peter, and both Matthew and Peter would have been present on that occasion, could it be that they were too disgusted with the way Jesus was treated by the people of his own village to mention it by name? Speculation, of course, but perhaps worth considering. We're not told of how the disciples reacted to the behaviour of the Nazarenes, but one can imagine Peter, with his fierce loyalty, ready to take on anyone who offended the Master. But the evangelists are silent on the subject. Matthew writes only that he did not work many miracles there because of their lack of faith. Mark goes further, stating that he could work no miracles there apart from healing a few sick. This sounds odd, since these cures were surely miracles too, but they were probably not spectacular cures, such as the raising of the daughter of Jairus, which we heard of last week. And so the visit ends sadly, with Jesus distressed at their lack of faith. Metaphorically, he does what he's told the apostles they must do in such circumstances. He shakes the dust of Nazareth from his feet and goes to the neighbouring villages instead. When he first preached in the Nazareth synagogue, according to Luke, he won the approval of all, and they were astonished by the gracious words that came from his lips. But then Luke records a change in the mood of the listeners, and his account ends with the whole synagogue rising in fury and hustling him out of town and attempting to throw him over the edge of a precipice.
Although Jesus, passing through the midst of them, went his way, a tradition developed that he leapt from the mountain, although the exact mountain from which he leapt is not agreed upon.
And such is legend. Scholars believe that Luke has combined two separate events to illustrate the fate of the gospel: welcome and then rejection. How long did the welcome last, one wonders? On the first occasion, when Jesus read from the book of Isaiah, he announced that he was the one referred to in the scriptures. He it was who would bring the good news to the poor, liberty to captives, new sight to the blind, and so on. By the time he returned to Nazareth, he'd already fulfilled some of these promises. The Nazarenes would have heard strange things, and there would have been a certain curiosity, perhaps even a superstitious kind of hope, that he would perform some wonder among them. And as Luke writes, Jesus anticipates this thought when he says to them,
"No doubt you will quote me the saying, 'Physician, heal thyself,' and tell me, 'We have heard all that happened in Capernaum. Do the same here in your own countryside.'"
But the sceptics seem to carry the day. The sceptics and the snobs. isn't this the carpenter? And a biblical scholar writes,
in the eyes of his fellow villagers, he's only a tecton, in Greek, a worker in wood, in stone or in metal, a general term to describe artisans, carpenters and masons. He is the son of Mary, a woman known in the village. It's the only time Mark mentions the mother of Jesus by name, and it's curious that the father's name is not there.
Luke, however, in his account, writes, they said, this is Joseph's son, surely. But Joseph by this time seems to have been long dead, and Jesus had taken over the family workshop. Until one day, when he must have said something to his mother on the lines of, I'm off now to be about my father's business. And off he went. How did his mother react? What happened to the carpenter's workshop? Did he pass it on to one of his relations, one of these brothers who are mentioned in the Gospel, cousin James or Joseph, perhaps? We don't know. And did he leave his mother just like that? Or did he come back now and then, incognito or at night, perhaps, to avoid meeting anyone he knew, until the time was ripe? A poet of our time, Tom Gunn, imagined what one of these meetings might have been like, with Mary doing most of the talking and Jesus speaking only one line, which is repeated throughout the poem, I am my own and not my own. Here is a part of Jesus and his mother.
My only son, more God's than mine, stay in this garden ripe with pears.
I am my own and not my own.
I do not understand your words. I taught you speech. We named the birds. You marked their big migrations then like any child. So turn again to silence from this place of crowds.
I am my own and not my own.
Why are you sullen when I speak? Here are your tools, the saw and knife and hammer on the bench. Your life is measured here in week and week, planed as the furniture you make. And I will teach you like a wife to be my own and all my own. Yet I remember how you went to speak with scholars in furred gown. Are you the boy I bore alone, no doctor near to cut the cord? I cannot reach to call you Lord. Answer me. As my only son.
I am my own and not my own.
Well, that's just one man's imagined encounter of Mary and Jesus after his first departure from Nazareth to begin his public life. His mother would have known it would happen sooner or later, this breaking of the umbilical cord. Every mother knows that the moment will come when her fledglings will fly the nest. She might try to delay it, but she knows that eventually she must bow to the inevitable. It's all part of the natural pattern. Our children are only lent to us, as the Lebanese poet wrote.
Your children are not your children. Though they are with you, yet they belong not to you. You may house their bodies, but not their souls. For their souls dwell in the house of tomorrow. For life goes not backward, nor tarries with yesterday. You are the bows from which your children, as living arrows, are sent forth. The archer sees the mark upon the path of the infinite, and he bends you with his might that his arrows may go swift and far. Let your bending in the archer's hand be for gladness.
A mother may grieve at the going of a child, but she will rejoice vicariously, for the child is going towards life. Mary, however, had been told at the temple presentation that a sword would pierce her heart, and although she'd accepted God's will right from the beginning, as Jesus grew to manhood, she must have felt more and more the shadow of that sword approaching. Sooner or later, her son would be leaving this domestic haven. For what? She could only leave it in God's hands, as she had always done. We're not told that Mary was present that day in the synagogue, only that the disciples were with him. And what about all the relations we hear about in the Gospel? Were they there? And who were they anyway? A scholar reminds us that we hear of brothers and sisters of Jesus in various gospel passages. But, he writes,
these terms are not to be taken literally. The Jewish and Aramaic languages, in fact, don't have separate words for the varying degrees of kinship, so the words may mean relations in general, or cousins, as in this passage.
In a note to the Vulgate version of Matthew's account, we read that the brethren, or brothers, were the children of Mary, wife of Cleophas, sister to our Blessed Lady, and therefore, according to the usual style of Scripture, they were called brethren, that is, near relations to our Saviour. And in fact, if we go to John's Gospel, we may read that on Calvary there stood by the cross of Jesus his mother and his mother's sister, Mary of Cleophas, and Mary Magdalene. While in Matthew,
there were there many women afar off, who had followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering unto him, among whom was Mary Magdalene, and Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee.
Although John calls Mary of Cleophas Our Lady's sister, she points out that that could apply to any close female relation, and he adds,
Hegesippus, who was born early in the next century, says that Cleophas was St. Joseph's brother, so that his wife would have been Our Lady's sister-in-law.
So there we are. You pay your money and you take your choice. One of the questions, the last in order, which we heard the crowd exclaim, was, aren't his sisters our neighbours here? And Sheed comments,
it looks as if the two families, Mary and Jesus, Mary of Cleophas and her children, were living close together, very much as one family, in Nazareth, perhaps after the deaths of Joseph and Cleophas.
But, as the same writer observes,
there is so much about all this that the evangelists do not tell us.
They were concerned with more important matters than family relationships. And what's important here is the reaction of the Nazareth synagogue. They found him too much for them. They would not accept him. And in yet another version, they took offence at him. To this last, a note runs.
Jesus' fellow countrymen would not accept the fact that the wisdom and authority of God was to be found in a humble artisan living among them, and whose cousins and whole family they knew well. This taking offence is unbelief.
And another writes, the Nazarenes were unable to grasp the value of his word or to see beyond the humble exterior of Christ. He could not do many miracles there, is the Vulgate version of Mark, and the footnote explains,
not for want of power, but because he would not work miracles in favour of obstinate and incredulous people who were unworthy of such favours.
In other words, Jesus was not going to cast his pearls before swine. And he exclaims bitterly,
no prophet is without honour except in his native place, among his own kindred and in his own house.
A prophet is only despised in his own country, runs the Jerusalem Bible version. And Luke writes, no prophet is ever accepted in his own country. What were our Lord's real feelings on this occasion, at this reception? He is amazed at their lack of faith. He wondered, marvelled at their unbelief. So much did their lack of faith distress him. The Gospel ends with Jesus making the rounds of the neighbouring villages, but Nazareth, his hometown, he puts behind him forever, as Bargellini writes.
From that moment, as he no longer has a real family, because he has chosen all humanity for his family, so he will no longer have a homeland, because his homeland will be the whole world.
On the purely human level, however, this cutting of ties must have generated in him that heartbreaking feeling all exiles have experienced at the moment of farewell, and an upsurge of nostalgia for all that home had been. The warmth of family evenings together, tools laid aside now, the quiet time after the simple meal and prayer, a sharing of the day's events. All this will now be consigned to memory. Some day, however, a voice or a scent will evoke that long-lost time when the Holy Family belonged to themselves alone. Music is one of the most powerful agents in this respect, And D.H. Lawrence reminds us of this common human experience in his poem Piano.
Softly, in the dusk, a woman is singing to me, taking me back down the vista of years till I see a child sitting under the piano, in the boom of the tingling strings and pressing the small, poised feet of a mother who smiles as she sings. In spite of myself, the insidious mastery of song betrays me back till the heart of me weeps to belong to the old Sunday evenings at home, with winter outside and hymns in the cozy parlour, the tinkling piano our guide. So now it is vain for the singer to burst into clamour with the great black piano appassionato. The glamour of childish days is upon me. My manhood is cast down in the flood of remembrance. I weep like a child for the past.
In the life of the Prophet of Nazareth, there will be no room for sentimentality or personal nostalgia. But the Son of God has a human heart, and one day, in the not-too-distant future, he will weep. Not for Nazareth, but for Jerusalem.
And warm thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for yet another moving programme. Meanwhile, as always at this time of week, time to join our expert on all things Vatican, Joan Lewis. So, Joan, a busy week, beginning with the end of the Pauline year.
Oh, exactly, the end of the Pauline year, and we had just begun the year for priests, and the Pope bestowed palliums on 34 metropolitan archbishops, and of course each of those new archbishops was in town with family and friends, so they come with pilgrimages and spend 4, 5, 6 days and have the individual masses and lunches and dinners.
That bestowing of the palliums is really a moving ceremony.
It's a beautiful ceremony. Just the story behind the pallium. And it's interesting to note, I don't know how many of our listeners know, that the pallium, this band of wool that goes over the head, lies on the shoulders of the archbishop and then has a short extension in front and back. And it's embroidered with 7 wool black crosses. This is a symbol of their authority as a metropolitan archbishop and their unity with the Holy Father. But also, and think about it, you know, Jesus was the good shepherd. Remember when the image we all have of him carrying the sheep on his shoulder.
Yeah,
so
right.
You have lamb's wool, the wool of little baby lamb woven into the palliums.
That's blessed in the Feast of St. Agnes, isn't it?
Exactly. January 21st of every year, the little lambs are blessed.
You get lambs inside St. Peter's Basilica in that
yes.
day.
Yes, and the papal apartments. And once, I don't remember how many years ago, a dozen or so, John Paul had them, the little lambs are all decorated, and they have flowers on the little wreath of flowers on their head, and their basket is decorated, and they're brought in. There's all these different people that come. And Pope John Paul had them 1 year. January 21st was on a Wednesday, so he had them brought into the audience hall so that, you know, many thousands of people could see it. But interestingly enough, the pallium is not bestowed on a person for the individual. The pallium is bestowed really because of a place. So it's not bestowed on Archbishop Dolan as Timothy Dolan, he's the Archbishop of New York, so it's a place. But the Pope had a wonderful homily that day, and he quotes the first letter of St. Peter, who calls Jesus the Bishop of Souls. And the Pope talked about how a bishop must watch over his flock as God watches over and cares for the entire world. So it's his flock, it's his family. He has to be there in the good and bad. And it was really a very, very moving homily.
Of course, the big event also on Monday was the encyclical.
And, you know, Caritas in Veritate, Pope Benedict's third encyclical. And, of course, the name of an encyclical is always Latin. It comes from the first several words, sometimes two, sometimes three, of the encyclical, the original version of which is always in Latin. And this is expected to be a social encyclical, also looking at the global economic crisis. And it took the Holy Father a little while to write it because he started in 2007. However, the vicissitudes of this ever-changing global crisis, the ups and downs of it, are made him kind of like sit back and he would add new considerations and new thoughts to it. So
he had a lot of economists working on it as well.
Yes.
Together with him, no?
Exactly. And it'll be presented on July 7th. That was just announced this week, and on Tuesday, July 7th, but it was actually signed on the solemnity of Peter and Paul. So, and then
the Pope wanted, you know, that date on the encyclical, didn't he?
He did. He did. What he did say Sunday at the Angelus was that it was going to be published imminently. It was very close to publication. And then it was only days later when the actual publication was announced. And, you know, you've got to translate this into a lot of languages, so it takes time. But what I found interesting, and a lot of people I've talked to found interesting, they expected Pope Benedict to perhaps base a lot of his thoughts, not base them on, but use to a great extent Pope John Paul's 1991 encyclical, Centesimus Annus, which, of course, was 100 years after Leo XIII's Rerum Novarum. And yet the Pope announced at the Angelus on Sunday that the encyclical takes up the social themes contained in Paul VI's document, 1967, so 42 years ago, Populorum Progressio. So I'm going to kind of take a look at that this weekend and see where Benedict is taking his inspiration from.
June the 30th. There was an event in the Pauline Chapel that had just been restored, now the 16th century Pauline Chapel, where the fresco is by Michelangelo.
It is absolutely breathtaking. And I have to tell you, it was doubly breathtaking for me. I talked to a number of colleague journalists, and I said, have you ever seen this before? And they hadn't. And I'm going to say 15 or so years ago, I saw the chapel and don't remember the circumstances, but, you know, a priest or Monsignor friend in the Vatican, I was up in that area and he said, have you ever seen the Pauline Chapel? And he opened the doors and some of the light came in, of course, from the Sala Regia from which you enter. But I want to tell you, it was so dark. It was dark with age, with the dirt that came from candles burning, with so many different things. Plus, they had carpeting, dark carpeting on the floor and partly up some of the sidewalls. And I mean, the floor is just stunning in itself. The floor, the ceiling, Michelangelo's two frescoes. But the chapel was so dark, and I remember saying to Monsignor, I don't recall seeing a room this dark in the Vatican. So they brought this whole thing back to life. Plus, what they did was install a radical, beautiful new lighting system. You see the effects of light, but you don't see the lights themselves, and it's very beautiful, but especially the huge, I think it's 445 square feet each, mosaics, the crucifixion of Peter on the right and the conversion of St. Paul on the left. And the interesting thing, two interesting things about St. Peter, he didn't want to, felt that he did not feel he was worthy to be crucified like Christ. He wanted to be crucified upside down. And instead of having his head lying fully back on the cross and in a prone position, his head is lifted up. That had to require huge energy. And he's kind of looking out as if he's looking at us for help or prayers or something. That's number one. They discovered the original plan of Michelangelo, because they could find the design, was to have St. Peter's head back on the cross. And then Michelangelo obviously had a message and he changed that. Secondly, the nails that you see in St. Peter's right hand and on his feet were not there. They were not painted by Michelangelo. They were done at a later date. So very interesting things coming out. And the sad part of it is I could talk for half an hour about the beauty of the chapel and the work that went into restoration. And probably no one listening to us is ever going to get to see it. Because it's not like the Sistine Chapel.
Yeah. We've heard more about the Redemptoris Mater Chapel, which was restored.
That's stunning, too. And that's mosaics. And you can visit that online on the Vatican's website. There's a part of the website that says papal basilicas and chapels, and you can actually visit that online.
Well, no doubt they'll put Pauline on soon, no?
Hopefully they will, because they've done video. We were not allowed to take pictures, but they have done a DVD of it, including the restoration, and they gave all of the journalists a CD with pictures so we could, you know, use those with signed permission. So lots of news. So it was John Paul to want the restoration of this, and then it's Benedict on July 4th inaugurating it with Vespers.
Of course, then he had his usual appointment on Wednesday, Pope Benedict, didn't he, with pilgrims. And, of course, the year for priests, which began on the Feast of the Sacred Heart.
On June 19th. He talked again at that.
He spoke about that.
What he said was that he announced that he will be dedicating for the coming months his Wednesday catechesis to the man, Saint Jean-Marie Vianney, the curé of ours, who is the whole inspiration for this year for priests, his writings, his life, and everything else. And so Benedict's intention is, if there's some priest out there who doesn't know the curé of ours very well, his very saintly life, obviously he is a saint, but just the fact that his ministry and his priesthood were one and the same. His whole personal life was his ministry and his priesthood, and that's what the part of the message, I think, that I'm gathering from Benedict's words that he wants to, get out. This is interesting. The Pope explained that the aim of every priest's mission is cultural, so that men can offer themselves to God as holy and living hosts to please him, thus deriving from him that charity which they are called to offer one another abundantly. So, and then the Pope stressed actually several times last week at the start of the year and Wednesday that missionary proclamation, your mission work and worship can never be suspended. So you have the sacrament, mission and sacrament are intertwined. They're almost one.
Pope Benedict, I noticed, mentioned the Vatican Council, the Second Vatican Council, a couple of times, and he did so on Wednesday, didn't he, as well?
Well, that actually was very interesting. He said, following Vatican Council II, again, this audience that is dedicated to the Year of the Priest and Saint Vianney, the Pope said, in some places, the impression arose that there were more important things in the mission of priests in our time. Some people believed that the priority was to build a new society, so you were going to become kind of a help agency more than a spiritual. And that's where the Pope really went into stressing the two essential, what he called the two essential elements of priestly ministry, which we basically just mentioned, word and sacrament, the pillars of the priestly mission.
Joan, I'd like to thank you very much. And I'd like to wish you a happy birthday.
Thank you very much. It's been a wonderful week and my birthday's been more than 24 hours. So it's been great. Thank you.
See you next week. Heartfelt thanks there to Joan Lewis for sharing with us her expertise. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org.
Been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.